a Friday in December, fairly wet December, and we're actually in London. We, of course, being the Midweek Drive team, and I can say we now because we have the awesome Zoe Jameson with us. Zoe, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Now, Zoe, would you like to share with the listener where exactly we are today?
Well, we're in a very exclusive location. We're in the poster bar of the Royal Academy.
Exactly. Yeah, the next, I mean, after we've done Giant Onions in Harrogate, where else can we go other than the poster bar at the Royal Academy?
Indeed.
We're going to be joined in a few moments by Richard Fitzwilliams, who is one of our cultural correspondents. He's going to be hot-footing it from his recent material with the BBC. Even Ben Lewis might be putting in a strange and wonderful cameo appearance as well. Zoe, talk to us a little bit about your first thoughts as you came through the door. I take it you didn't have any problems with security.
No problems with the security. Plenty of years of DeBerry have helped me out with that one.
I thought so. I mean, I kind of alerted folk that they're actually there, but just in case, all was well.
Yep, smile and wave.
And your thoughts, is this your first time at the Royal Academy?
It is indeed, yes. It's very impressive, isn't it?
Well, I felt like there's a nice symmetry because obviously from the Royal Veterinary College to the Royal Academy, I mean, clearly royalty is in your blood.
I'm not sure about that, but we'll see.
You're listening to Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio on location with the Midweek Drive at the Royal Academy in association with Pharma Nord Nutritional Supplements. Spike is with us, don't worry, we'll take some photographs as well. We've also actually presented Zoe with the official calendar. So, Zoe, you've made it. You are now officially part of the whole thing. You're in the calendar several times, actually.
I know. Very exciting.
And great news, Zoe, because Richard Fitzwilliams has arrived.
He has indeed.
We can now start this little wandering tour in earnest. Richard, I'm aware of the wonderful Royal Academy Astronomical Society, but this is my first time, actually, amazingly enough, in the Royal Academy of Arts. But good to see you as ever.
Well, I am surprised at that, I have to say, because the Royal Academy of Arts is, of course, a very prestigious body. I mean, it began 251 years ago, hence you can imagine the anniversary it celebrated last year.
Which is why we're here, Zoe, to celebrate the 251st year. You know, just again, slightly offbeat, really, from that point of view.
A bit behind the times, but never mind.
Slightly behind the times, indeed, because George III wanted a body that really did give the arts some form of voice. It's rather sad, actually, if you consider. If you look at the honour system, for example, you couldn't honour top artists or top celebrity figures in the arts and sciences properly, except with knighthoods. I mean, Sir Joshua Reynolds, the first president of the Royal Academy, had knighthood, until the Order of Merit in 1902 was founded by Edward VII, the monarch who never read a book. I'll say it was equipped. But here we've got a remarkable institution, an institution that for a very large number of years, with its annual exhibition in the summer, this used to be very much a centre of London society life. Now it's, I'm putting it mildly and generously, a jumble of 1,300 paintings, but they were certainly well hung last year. This was the year that commemorated 250 years of the institution. This also was the year where, I mean, we're standing in what used to be, years ago, the Museum of Mankind, and subsequent to that, the Academy took it over but didn't use it much. For their 250th, they have expanded the entrance from the Burlington Arcade side of it and the famous courtyard, which everyone's familiar with, right through. So, in fact, you get an idea with what I thought we'd go upstairs and see some of the treasures of the Royal Academy, because they are on show for
the public and general people in all sorts of things. This is Lucian Freud, the self-portrait. Zoe, your thoughts, because this is also your first visit to the Royal Academy.
It is indeed, yeah. Bringing it back and marking it on the map, I suppose.
Well, when it comes to the exhibitions, what's fascinating is now that they've got the space to mount a lot of them, and also various exhibits by individual artists, and also a nod to the past and some of the presidents and some of the top painters and so on. I think we should go up and see some of these. But there is Lucian Freud, and these are mainly but not only self-portraits. They're called the 50... Basically, he appears in, I think, the vast majority of them. But they are fascinating because Freud, who died a few years ago at the age of nearly 90, was our top portrait painter. I mean, his unflinching gaze was amazing, and there were a variety of amazing things about him, whether it was his private life, which was, you could argue,
questionable. Questionable.
Certainly unusual, but certainly was also...
But that's because he never did an interview with Emily Maitlis. I'm sure it would have actually taken a whole U-turn if he'd done that.
There is, of course, that aspect of Freud's work. But equally, if you were a sitter, you could sit for hundreds, thousands of hours. In fact, there are examples of 2,500 hours. It was quite unbelievable. I mean, he was a perfectionist to the point where, I mean, the word really did have a unique meaning for him. And there are also uncompromising studies and nude studies. When he was older, he painted himself in the nude. And you can follow, if you go and look at the exhibition, Freud, the development of Freud as a portrait painter, which is what he was best known as. I mean, he did paint foliage. The interesting thing is, when I discovered this, when I saw the Pompidou Centre exhibition in 2002 in Paris, I didn't know that he was a painter of the floral, of foliage and plants and so forth. Well, he was and he wasn't, because he wouldn't stir beyond his studio. But there's one upstairs that's very interesting with a nude Freud a self-portrait of Freud in the part of what appears to be, he's almost enveloped in a gigantic plant, which is most intriguing. There are also some quite disturbing aspects of his character. There's a portrait of his first wife and a chef. Freud is in shadow. You get the impression that the marriage is in trouble, which indeed it was. There's also a portrait of one of his nude models. She had to pose for hours and hours in a pose so restrictive that she had to have osteopathic treatment afterwards. So he was a hard taskmaster. He was remarkable. I would also add that those of us who have been seeing The Crown, I mean, I would say Claire Foy's Queen was rather like Annie Gonew's romantic vision, which was so attractive when he painted in 1953. This is the popular portrait of the Queen. I would say Claire Foy...
At least she kept her clothes on. That's the important thing.
That is...
We can't have a majesty taking a joke. It wouldn't be good, Zoe.
No, not today.
I would say Claire Foy's Queen in Series 3 resembles Lucien Freud's portrait of the Queen in 2001, as though she had Atlas bearing the weight of the world on her shoulders.
Let's not go there, Richard. Let's step away from the challenges that she's been faced with.
She's certainly... Well, my royal family has had a dreadful year. It doesn't mean they won't pull back, but it does mean that they have to rethink from the point of view of publicity, their advisors, and also who the inner core is going to be and what the Sussexes decide to do, as well as banish Andrew. It's got to happen. People won't stand for it.
Well, Richard Harshwartz, what do you think, Zoe?
Taskmaster indeed.
Well, thanks to Richard, we have successfully actually managed to leave our cloaks and belongings in the cloakroom, which is wonderful. And Richard, we're currently seeing what I suppose, to be honest, is very much a case of installation space, artistic space.
Yes, in which there are some installations, and quite honestly, passing. But if there are two videos on the walls, and you know, you can make of those what you wish. But there is what looks to me like a piece of cardboard lying on the floor, which has obviously special meaning. Now, I do have to say that to me it looks like...
A piece of cardboard lying on the floor. Zoe, put the checkbook away. It's not worth several million.
Abstract. It's very abstract.
Well, the thing with certain types of art, obviously you must experiment, and obviously that's what art has been doing for, well, a very, very long time now. But it is also true that sometimes the experiments don't work, and if something looks as though it's been discarded by accident, that is not something that tends to hold the attention.
It's a thought, isn't it?
It is indeed, but we still find ourselves here, don't we?
Shall we take the lift up to the next level? I mean, yes. I'm just intrigued by that. I mean, it looks as though it could be high technology. Failing that, Zoe, it could actually just be a work of art.
Well,
that sort of
could indeed be a work of art, and I'm glad you recognise the possibilities that were inherent in the doors and the also the gap between the doors, which has a special
signifier, lacunae, almost.
Noam
Chomsky would actually work our way through this process as we take our way through something I never actually thought we'd do, which we're actually doing the running commentary as we go into the lift of the Royal Academy.
It is a divided world, and that split.
It's Trumpian, isn't it? It's Trumpian and yet vaguely Boristian as well.
Well, you could say that it was symbolic of Brexit because the lift is evenly divided, 50-50, and that is what the latest poll has shown.
And we emerge into the first floor.
I can assure you that our current political crisis is anything but humorous, and I deprecate laughter.
Now, this was something I saw earlier this morning. I was intrigued by this whole collection of busts on filing cabinets, which I just think was amazing.
No, it's a vast collection, and some of them must have been busts used in early years for students. It's an extension of what we've just been looking at, of how students were taught. I think that looks like Palazzi to me, Eduardo Palazzi. I'm not an admirer, but he was one of the...
It's like an internal combustion engine writ large.
Well, it looks like several things, and how you interpret it and how I interpret it and how others interpret it is part of its appeal.
Zoe, what's your thought on this one?
Yeah, it's really interesting. They're all displayed on different things and, yeah, all at different levels.
Impressed that Zoe, clearly she's on the case, Richard, because she discovered quite, you know, deliberately, she said, find the ancestors. Zoe, you found the guide to all of these busts.
I have indeed, yeah. There's loads of them.
Well, that is Dame Elizabeth Frink, which I mentioned, yes. Yes, they are an unusual collection.
And as I say, in terms of that whole notion of what is art, and I don't want to go down a semiotic line of Roland Barthes, because after all he was being the father of semiotics, but ultimately he ended his life when he was run over by a laundry van in Belgium, I believe. But in terms of this, is this a case of it's an intrinsic part of our Western culture, or is it a kind of global culture that we've got here?
Well, clearly, I mean, the specific busts that we're looking at, if they're under the ancestors, if you look at the various sculptors, most of them look as though they are British. I don't think all of them are. I mean, there's no question that busts, for example, and busts are also likenesses, you had in ancient Rome with the Roman emperors. And it's rather extraordinary that apart from the funerary portraits which you had in, they were found, a lot of them in Egypt, there's 75 of them, Greek and Roman funerary portraits, which basically continued the Roman tradition of likeness. Then you had religious art dominate for so many hundred years. I mean, it was until the 16th century. And subsequent to that, the sculptors created likenesses, and here you've got some rather good likenesses. But then here's the question, is a likeness what?
What does it capture? What does it capture about the innate essence of an individual?
That depends on the individual bust and the individual artist, and that is where one must look at it. I mean, we've got in front of us about 50 busts, so it's hard to be sweeping other than the fact that most of them are likenesses or appear to be.
And a little shout-out to use the radio vernacular, Richard, to Ellen, of course, from the public relations team here, who has facilitated this little location report. So thank you, Ellen, for allowing us to actually do this little wander around.
Indeed, and I would add my thanks.
We have moved into what I have to say is tremendously awesome Villarreal, I think we actually have as the artist behind this. If I just move backwards from the whole system here, Leo Villarreal. Extraordinary. I mean, describe what we're seeing here, Richard.
We are entering a darkened room, and in front of us there are huge screens, several along, smaller ones on the side of the wall, but there is a giant huge screen, and there are various flashing dots of light. And the effect, I have to say, is almost as though a meteor or a comet was about to flash into the sky and dissolve. It's really very impressive. This is a sort of art that it lures you in, whereas the shall we say, conceptual work that we were looking at earlier can mean that you move on rather faster than you normally would.
I'm particularly interested in this because for me, and obviously art can be decoded at so many levels, this is exactly what I was talking about with Zoe only a matter of moments ago when we were talking about the Big Bang philosophy and the notion that ultimately, Richard, we are the stuff that hydrogen atoms will evolve into given several billion years of evolution. You see, those little stars could well be your distant ancestors.
It's very possible that they might be, but certainly whatever it is, it's what you've got is a sort of, it's kaleidoscopic. It's fascinating. It's playing with light and also playing with, it's completely soundless, but what I find is I'm drawn towards the different ways that the particles of light on a dark screen move, and it's fascinating. I mean, this is skilled, and also it's imaginative, and it does conjure up visions, you could say, of other worlds.
Zoe, is this the kind of thing that Drew Barry could actually use as a backdrop for the next series of country shows?
Yeah, maybe. We'll have to get some water features. It's very intriguing.
Well, with the words, good heavens, my words, not Richard's, we've actually just been struck by a particularly positive image, or maybe not so positive, Zoe.
What an entrance.
Richard, what are we looking at here?
What we're looking at is Sir Thomas Lawrence's portrait of Satan, a gigantic naked figure.
Nigel Farage. Sorry, apolitical point
there. I have to remain apolitical, as you understand. Summoning his legions, it's rather like out of Milton's Paradise Lost. You can picture a vision like this, but it's, putting it mildly, as you enter the gallery of the Royal Academy's treasures, it is, shall we say, somewhat striking.
And for a moment I thought I was actually seeing William Rees-Mogg, but obviously no. Oh, Jacob Rees-Mogg even. It's very confusing, the Rees-Moggs.
Satan. I leave to your imagination the various guises of Satan.
So, just for the benefit of our listener, where exactly in the Royal Academy are we currently located, Richard? Don't say Satan's den.
We are currently located in what used to be the Museum of Mankind, and which was taken over by the Academy and then made part and parcel of the building by the clever redevelopment of the entire building to celebrate 250 years. And what we're looking at are the Academy's treasures. So behind us here is the first president of the Royal Academy, Sir Joshua Reynolds. It's a self-portrait. As you can see, he saw himself. There's a bust of Michelangelo in the background, and I think I'm right. Yes, there is. And Reynolds, therefore, saw himself in the classical tradition, and obviously, you could say it's egotistical, but there's no question he had much to be proud about, and he saw himself very much in that tradition, and as you see, he's posed most impressively. It's a very fine self-portrait. It's very well known.
I'm also particularly pleased that he actually kept his clothes on, Richard, because obviously in the light of some of our earlier discussions, you know, sometimes one thinks Joshua might have been very tempted to go déshabillé.
Not in the 18th century.
Oh, I don't know. Zoe, your thoughts?
Yeah, it's very impressive in here, isn't it?
Any favourites so far, Zoe, from what we've actually seen? I mean, I'm just about to look at the classic Last Supper, which has its own image just behind us from that point of view.
That, of course, is a copy of Leonardo's Last Supper. And
for a moment, Richard, I thought I was going to catch you out there. I thought you were going to say Michelangelo. Saying, no, it was Leonardo da Vinci.
No. I was looking at Michelangelo in the portrait of Sir Joshua Reynolds, a self-portrait. Here we've got, it's a very, very impressive copy of the Last Supper. And the real Last Supper in Italy is actually, I mean, the
it's in need of restoration.
In the best of state, it is in need of restoration. And this is, you know, it's nice that this copy, and it's very useful for art students, is at the Academy.
Zoe, as we look at this, I must admit, I would have to say, Richard's walking away now, I've got a little thing I must share with him. He's coming back now. The key thing, as I was saying, Zoe, about this particular aspect is this is one where I'd say, yes, you should not come and actually look at the Last Supper, even if it's a replica, on your mobile phone. You need to actually experience it, unlike most movies, which you can hardly watch on a mobile phone.
Yeah, I think you do indeed. It's amazing.
I think, Alex, the way yes? you are provocative is so outrageous. I'm tempted to think of a biblical allegory. They said, and you recall the, I mean, those...
Are we talking about a pre-lapsarian moment here, kind those, of thing before the fall?
Those of us who know the Bible, and I'm sure some listeners will relate to us.
You're familiar with the Bible. It's a fine basic instruction booklet for the life experience.
Oh, dear.
It's just simply the fate of Jezebel. They said, throw her down, and they threw her down, and there was nothing left of her but the palms of her hands and the soles of her feet. Just a word of warning.
We have moved on, and let's not go into Lot's wife either, because before we know it, we're into Gomorrah and all sorts of things, etc., and then you're back into politics.
Surely not.
Moving on.
Zoe, the time has come for us to have what basically no location report with Richard Fitzwilliams would be complete without, if I'm not employing a double negative. No, I'm not. It's, of course, a tale of Richard's ancestry and background. This is awesome. Are you ready for this, Zoe?
Yeah, I did wonder where you're going with that, but that sounds very good.
Richard, take it away.
Well, we're just in front of the Shield of Achilles, of course, a figure in the Trojan War by Homer, which I recommend in this context, the exhibition Troy in the British Museum, which is...
Is it as good as the recent movie, Richard, that we actually had with Sandals and so on, with Brad Pitt, I believe?
That is true, and I would fault the exhibition simply because it did put up the poster of Brad Pitt and Diane Kruger and Peter O'Toole.
What's not to love?
Lots not to love. It was a complete catastrophic mess. But they didn't mention Robert Wise's one attempt at an epic, the 1956 Helen of Troy, which I thought was very good. It was very enjoyable anyway. But the reason I mention Troy is because Flaxman, one of the top sculptors in the 19th century, he has sculpted the Shield of Achilles, who was the great... Greek warrior in the siege of Troy, and Flaxman, in fact, did the memorial in the St. Paul's Covent Garden to my great-great-great-great-grandfather, who was Edward Hall, and he was the secretary of the Whig Club, that now the Liberals or Liberal Democrats, from its foundation until his death in 1797. And it's rather interesting that, it's rather nice to have that up, but Flaxman did famous figures of his period, and it happens that one of the Flaxman, as you see here...
It's very impressive the way it's classic 3D, you always say it's a 3D printer would have produced this today, but perhaps a little bit more in terms of the way that the horses are literally bounding out of the shield.
Indeed they are. Flaxman was a very skilled figure, and he was the most... an architect most in demand at that time.
Zoe, I know you specialise in equine and horse matters and so on. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, they're literally jumping out at us. I think the attention to detail is amazing.
Very good. And also, fascinating, Richard, you actually mentioned Robert Wise there, of course, known for Star Trek The Motion Picture, The Sound of Music, and The Day the Earth Stood Still, as well as The Magnificent Ambersons.
Oh, The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Clartu Barada Nicto.
But what did he do with The Magnificent Ambersons?
I think you'll find he probably did the bulk of the directing because Orson Welles effectively gave up, really.
That I did not know.
Well, I'd like to share some sort of useful snippets of information. It's also, I have to say, Richard, in terms of if people are looking for a particular oasis of calm in the height of the metropolis, I have to say coming to the Royal Academy is a really wonderful exhibition because it's a real place to actually meditate and just gather one's thoughts together.
It is now because it has been redone properly and because there's access to various bars and restaurants and so on that there were not before, and also the spaces and the lifts and so on. It's completely different from what it was 2 years ago. I mean, every building needs, or most buildings need restoration every so often. And this really needed a gigantic amount of work, and it's had it.
I passed the Linnaeus Society, obviously, on entering this, and Linnaeus, of course, known for his classification, amongst other things. It was nice to see that, as somebody who's very much just focusing on the science side of the Royal Academy, that these artists, actually, they did some good stuff as well, Zoe.
Yeah, it's really cool to see.
And we've crossed another threshold now in our little wander through into what we've passed Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey and so on. Nothing to do with the Simpsons, in case people are out there who believe that they are amusing. Or so say, oh yes, duh. No, diddly different Homer. But in this particular instance, Michelangelo, the Virgin and Child with the Infant St. John, also known as the Taddei Tondo.
Yes, this is a particularly famous work by Michelangelo. I think it is one of the very few, possibly the only one in Britain. And the Royal Academy custodians of it and are very, very proud that they have this. It's called the Taddei Tondo. It's one of the, here it says, icons of the Royal Academy. And it shows Jesus and Mother Mary and the young St. John the Baptist. And rather lovely.
And 500 years ago, a little over 500 years, about 515 years ago, it just shows just a drop in cosmic time, Zoe.
Indeed, that was a bit before my time.
Oh, I don't know, I'm sure you were there. I recently sort of found out that apparently, according to one line, my last incarnation was as a Ukrainian called Anton in the 10th century, which is interesting.
It's interesting also, if you look at...
may not be verified, by the way, that story, just in case people are worrying, saying it was around 1,000 years ago.
What is interesting, Michelangelo believed that he was, so to speak, the hand of God, that God placed whatever he was sculpting in the marble, and that he then cut loose what had been placed there by divine hand. So it's lovely that that's there.
The classic line that, with respect to the sculptor actually sees what can be revealed when you actually chip away from the marble, and you actually see the unveiling underneath. As I say, just echoing that line. Speaking on another topic with which respect to movies, The Agony and the Ecstasy.
The Agony and the Ecstasy, I always thought was rather cruelly done by when it came to critics. It was Carol Reed's, and Reed had not declined as he later did at that time, because it was to make Oliver, which won an Oscar, which was fantastic. The problem with The Agony and the Ecstasy...
I mixed up my Olivers with My Fair Ladies. A horrendous mistake, Richard.
No.
Food, glorious food. Wouldn't it be lovely?
No. But what I thought was entertaining about The Agony and the Ecstasy, firstly, the sets were magnificent, because I was at the Sistine Chapel a couple of months ago, and it's just wonderful to see it again. It really is one of the most glorious creations of mankind, and I think the film's sets and costumes are very impressive, but it is true that apart from the opening battle sequence, it's certainly not speedy. That was also an excuse for those who didn't like it to say all agony, no ecstasy, and that sort of thing. But it was rather fun to see Charlton Heston as Michelangelo. It didn't look like the original Michelangelo, who was dwarfish. The homosexual theme was cut out and replaced with a romance with the Countess de' Medici, played by Diane Cilento, and Rex Harrison was Pope Julius, the warrior pope. I thought both of them, it was very entertaining to see the clash of temperaments between the two of them, which led to the creation of the Sistine.
And I know, Richard, you have never been so crass as to be one of the theatre critics who once reviewed Charlton Heston's performance in A Man for All Seasons that I saw a few years ago at the Savoy Theatre, as the most moving thing about this performance was Mr. Heston's hairpiece.
I didn't see it.
It's not good, is it, Zoe? Zoe, I'm going to ask you a few moments. I know we've just carried a smidgen of this, but what has been your favourite work of art you've seen so far?
I think The Last Supper so far has been... That coffee is unbelievable, yeah.
It does stand out, actually. This comes close to it, and I think I'm fondness for the cosmic experience we actually had earlier, but lots of really great stuff, and almost we need more time, Richard.
Well, there are, of course, there's the Freud exhibition of self-portraits, truly fascinating, and quite dark in some cases. He was certainly an artist.
Freud family, let's face it. You got your Emma Freud, you've got your Matthew Freud, you got your Clement Freud. I mean, Clement always looks a bit of a hangdog, really. And all those dog food commercials, it wasn't really good for the psyche.
I don't think further comment on Clement Freud would be a good idea.
Exactly. It's a whole new world. I mean, before you know it, we'll be talking about Jeremy Thorpe as well.
Before you know it.
Exactly. Richard, we have ascended to the second level, and as we spoke about earlier, the Lucian Freud exhibition is in full force here, and it's very popular.
There's absolutely no doubt this is an important show, and I've been to several exhibitions, large exhibitions of Freud's at the Pompidou Centre, at the National Portrait Gallery, and also at Tate Britain. This is a small exhibition, but it's also important because it's his self-portraits. Mm. And what is very significant is to see, and we're beginning at these early part of his career in 1940, and how he developed until his death in 2011, where he was absolutely unflinching, I mean, his nudes and so forth, but also the way he worked, which is what we'll see as we go round this exhibition. An artist, a perfectionist, who made models sit for hundreds, sometimes thousands of hours, who took years to finish a portrait, and who was regarded as our finest portrait painter because of his amazing technique, and also the results, which we're about to see, are certainly extraordinary.
Yeah, we're off on a little adventure, quite like our lift ride up here.
It was, particularly the way they recreated the feeling of the London Underground at rush hour by packing in as many people as possible. It's very impressive.
Indeed, yes.
Certainly the popularity of this exhibition is undoubted just by the sheer numbers of people that are actually wandering through this, but I'm struck by the quotes that I'm looking at present, Freud on drawing. The only way I could work properly was by using the absolute maximum of observation and concentration that I could possibly muster.
Well, if you look at some of his early works, apparently he didn't regard them as self-portraits so much as something that was a bit experimental, and he appears to have, and they'll see some examples as we go around the show. He experimented with the more abstract, but he eventually ended up firmly in the camp of the figurative painting, which is where he has, in fact, got his fame from as an amazing draftsman and figurative artist who specialised in portraiture, and included. Heavens, I mean, there are so many self-portraits. I mean, Rembrandt was famous for them. I mean, I don't know how many Freud did, but there were a lot of them.
In many ways, they were early selfies, Richard. It's just we use a digital format to actually do the self-portrait these days.
So they could.
Zoe, in terms of what we're looking at here, any thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, we're following his journey, which is intriguing. We've only just started, so we'll see what's to come.
Freud's approach to painting apparently throughout this period, his early period at least, marked by a preoccupation with line, combining expressive force with a quality of draftsmanship that led the critic Herbert Reed to describe him as the Ingres of existentialism.
Well, as we go round, and as I say, when we see some of his early works, they're very, very different from his later works in the second half of his life, particularly.
And with the words, people thought and said and wrote that my paintings were linear and defined by my drawing. I've never been that affected by writing, but I thought if that's at all true, I must stop. Is this the artist kind of being self-reflective? Is this the artist being pretentious? Is this the artist effectively just saying something that you thought would fill the copy at the time?
Well, what we see is the artist changing his style radically, because we've been seeing these rather surreal works where, he's obviously, reality is not what is emphasized in the works we've so far seen. From now on, we see works that are figurative and works also, whereas there are touches where he experiments with abstraction, that are recognizably Freud and the style that we know and associate him with. But equally, if you look across there, I mean, that is a spooky, rather sinister work. It's his first wife looking a little demonic, lying in bed, and then there's this predatory shadow above her, and that is Freud himself. So the messages in some of his works were decidedly dark.
Surely the message here is hashtag Me Too campaign earlier in the century.
I don't think that it would be an advertisement for that indeed. I mean, if you look at many great artists, and I mean the most recent exhibition of Gauguin mentioned child abuse, and there's no question that you cannot get away from certain attitudes from certain artists, and it's important to take the artist as he was in this, he or she was, but usually it does tend, of course, to be a he, and examine the various aspects of their work, both in their time, and of course, looking at the way he behaved and the way he painted and so forth in ours.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio's Midweek Drive on location at the Royal Academy, specifically at this particular part of the Lucian Freud exhibition. Our team, of course, Richard Fitzwilliams and Zoe James. And Zoe, thoughts so far?
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Wow.
Mirrors with self-portrait likenesses, or with self-portraits, I should say, likeness becomes a different thing, because in ordinary portraits you try to paint the person in front of you. Is this part of the line that you're saying, Richard, in terms of the perfectionist of Freud, that actually this is one of the reasons why some of his paintings took so long and so many sittings?
Well, I think that the reason his paintings took so long was the way he, the brushwork, the way he painted, his attitude toward, I mean, you're talking about, we'll come to some of them. We're talking about some examples I want to come to a bit later, where hundreds, if not thousands, of hours were spent. I mean, that's just phenomenal.
Well, there is a line, I think, which says 10,000 hours. It takes 10,000 hours at anything to actually become an expert in it, so maybe he was applying that technology.
Well, that's, it's hard to comment on that, but it's the one thing one can say is that there was no one with a style like Freud.
And in terms of time, of course, Zoe, little factoid for yourself, in 22,000 days, you'll be in your 80s.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. Richard and myself, obviously, will still be going then, and hopefully you'll be still part of the team.
Of course. Well, naturally, that goes without saying.
We are continuing our little promenade, reflections in the studio, Zoe, and Richard was actually sharing with us how some of the models who are certainly in a state of wearing very cold, because they're not wearing a stitch in any sort of form of clothing, were under an awful lot of... I mean, Richard, share with us, and they've got back pains, all sorts of things in terms of suffering for their art.
Well, they did, because Freud, being a perfectionist, also being Freud, there's absolutely no question that if you did sit for him, you could be, I mean, day after day. He liked four sittings a week from those he used as models, and this could be very demanding. They were hours at a stretch. Up to 5 hours, apparently, at a stretch was common, and they could last for months, even years. So you really, you're dealing with an afternoon model, you know, with reference to the light, it tended to be the same one. You're dealing with an evening one and one night and so on. I mean, there was no one like it. And there are those who might say, from a point of view of being a model, just as well. But equally, there's no question that, as I say, the result was that he is regarded as our greatest portrait painter. So the fact that he had this extraordinary way of painting and the length of time that he took, I mean, it's part parcel of what could be called his genius. There's no doubt. I mean, you're looking at four works here in this room. The model that I was referring to was here, where you can see that she's in an extremely uncomfortable position, and she had to keep that position for all those sittings. And then here, we've also got an interesting study. I've seen it before. I think I last saw it at the Tate, where you have two Irishmen, a businessman and his son, as I remember. Yes, it's called Two Irishmen. And interesting that he's a very... There's almost a stereotype there that if you had to guess where they are, which I think you might well get it right. And you can see...
Zoe, let's just test this. I mean, Zoe is from Northern Ireland, so would you actually identify these two people as Irish?
Yeah, it's funny how you say that, but it does kind of fit, doesn't it?
It does fit, because it's also... it's interesting that he painted... again, you can see the cityscape outside those studio windows. Freud, in his studio, liked looking out, but he didn't, as far as I know, venture out and paint.
And also, without being hugely politically correct, I must admit, Richard, the Irishmen get to keep their clothes on, and yet the women don't. That seems a little bit unfair.
I would point out that you are being mischievous and you're judging from three of his works in one room. That is no way to judge.
Just call me a Philistine, Richard. Just call me a Philistine.
That argument strips you naked. There are only four in this room.
Well, great news, because although we've completed the Lucian Freud exhibition and we've emerged from the Royal Academy, we might actually return to actually catch up with Alan Lewis in a wee while. But Zoe, we've been joined by another midweek drivette.
We have indeed. They've been following us on the streets of London.
And you've been carrying his calendar, you know, his awesome Ben Lewis calendar, which I know he's going to be very impressed with. Yes, the name gives it away. Richard it is. Ben Lewis. Exactly. That's the way. Sort of through. Ben, good to see you.
It's good to see you too. It's been a while, isn't it?
Yeah, when last I recall, you were at the graduation ceremony. I awarded you your prize, and then you never spoke to me again, basically. It was all Doug who basically monopolised the whole thing. I had to go and do a radio show.
Well, yeah, but...
We'll carry on after we've ordered. Orders have duly been put in. And, Richard, share with us, where are we? Because this is one of your haunts, I believe.
We are at the Naval and Military Club, nicknamed the In and Out. It moved here in 1999, and this is Lady Astor's old home. She was the first, minus or Countess Markowitz, who was a Sinn Féin member, never took her seat, first woman member of the House of Commons. Churchill and she famously clashed, and this was her London residence.
So presumably she wouldn't have gone on very well with the current incumbent at 10 Downing Street.
We can only speculate as to what.
Yeah, still avoiding that political line here. And honestly, it's like sort of Andrew Neil trying to pen people down. Unbelievable. Ben, tell us, what have you been doing since you graduated?
Oh, work mainly. It's quite a lot of separate things. I work with different people, so I'm all over the country at the moment. And yeah, it's been quite intense, but it's quite nice at the moment. It's a bit of a relaxed period, so yeah, it's quite a good opportunity, really. In fact, I ended up dropping Richard at the note a couple of weeks ago, asking if he was around on a weekend.
Yes, that's happy we linked up.
We did, yeah. But unfortunately, due to royal engagements, Richard was always busy, so it was
only 2 weeks ago. It was impossible. It has been, in fact, until relatively recently. I mean, the Andrew story is huge. The last member of the royal family, Edward VIII, abdicated. I mean, he's given up royal duties. I quote, for the foreseeable future. That means permanently. It must.
Zoe, let's move away from royal matters and such like. You're in the final year of your 7-year epic as a vet at the Royal Veterinary College. Are we persuading you to gradually join our media family?
I don't know. I'm having an interesting experience today, so I'll have to see what the day takes us.
Well, this is what we can guarantee you from that moment we first connected from that point of view. And you'll be pleased to know, Ben, that Zoe is a regular contributor every Wednesday on the Midweek Drive.
I know. I've been listening to the show.
Wow.
I bet that surprises you, doesn't it? That does surprise you.
I mean, I listen though, Richard. This is just, you know, I'm going to have a lie down.
No, well, it proves the reach of Siren FM, the reach of the Midweek Drive.
Exactly, and after a Freud exhibition, I don't think I can actually take any more. What the hey? We will motor on. You're listening to Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio. It's Midweek Drive on location in London with Zoe, with Ben, with Richard, and yes, Anna Lewis will be joining us later on for our final wrap-up of the day. Well, Zoe, we had a cameo appearance from Ben Lewis earlier in the day, of course. Ben has now left us. Richard Fitzwilliams has also left us to do all various other bits and pieces. But who has joined us now from out of Alex Leftuke's past life?
Well, we're joined by Anne Lewis.
The Anna Lewis. Anna Maria Lewis, to be precise. Anna, how long has it been?
It has been since 1984.
Oh, my goodness.
And you haven't changed a bit.
Neither have you.
Whoa. Yeah, and Anna still actually kept the cassette tapes of some of our early radio productions.
I have indeed, yep. They're in storage, but I've still got them.
These days, of course, you can download them. You realise that, Anna?
Oh, really? I never knew that. So, well, I'm learning something today.
So welcome to the Royal Academy. I say that as though it was ours. Obviously, you know, Zoe has staked a claim already from her veterinary science culture days, etc. Zoe, Anna's question was, what have we been doing today? So let's do a little pracy, a bit like the end of the show when we do our audio postcards. Share with the listener what they need to listen back to.
Okay, so we've done a bit of a tour of the Royal Academy this morning, and then we popped out for some refreshments, and now we're back, so...
Specifically went to the In and Out Club, a place that was originally set up, I believe, by Lady Astor.
Apparently so.
That's Richard Fitzwilliams for you. And Anna, you've also been quite busy because you've been doing various other things. So you, I mean, in many ways, you are designated not only as our regular Wednesday afternoon 5 o'clock go-to person, whether she's on the top deck of a number 37 bus or wherever, she'll be linking up there. What have you been doing today?
Well, I've literally been into Twickenham to do a bit of chores and came straight out here. So it's been Piccadilly is quite an exciting place to come, really. It's jolly.
And we've also selected a place to hopefully rendezvous, which is not too busy, not too hectic, really. So I think all's well to actually get this radio production going. So, as I say, weekly slots, clearly, from that point of view. I was sharing with Zoe how you contacted me via, I believe, that Facebook thing that was set up and said, was I the same person all those years ago? I thought, I don't have any children. You know, it can't possibly be. How do you feel now you're sort of back in the Midweek Drive fold?
Oh, it's great. It's great to be in touch. And thank you, Facebook. It's been brilliant having that possibility of linking up.
Who would have thought that, eh? One of our sort of early presenters, when the show actually was called the Associated or Assorted Joints and Ligaments Show.
Oh, my word. It's back.
Exactly. It's like, you know, just as though she's never been away. So how often do you frequent the Royal Academy, Anna?
Very rarely. I'm afraid I have a very jaded view of this place. I've been to the gift shop and I turn my nose up at it. It's overpriced and the stuff's really boring. So in terms of gifts, not good.
Just like Richard Fitzwilliams, you see, Anna is not afraid of voicing her opinions.
Indeed. Well, we've had a very interesting day here, haven't we?
I would certainly say that some of the exhibitions that were there in the collection zone, particularly the Valencia one, is very impressive. It's a star cosmos hypnotic sort of zone, which I thought was very, very impressive. Right up my street, as you might appreciate, Anna.
Well, I went to the Tate the other day, the Tate Britain, and it was impressive. And they have some very modern exhibitions that I'm not scared of or put off by, but I must admit, the Tate's more me than the Royal Academy.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to say I think Anna might have been possibly just a bit concerned about some of the Lucian Freud nude self-portraits.
Yeah, that is an exhibition of interest.
Don't go there, Anna. Honestly, don't go there. Obviously, if you're listening to this, feel free to obviously book tickets. And it was very popular.
Yeah, there were lots of people wandering around. So a popular exhibition here today, yeah.
And finding various quirky bits, I know that your passion, Anna, at least I suspect this, and it's one which basically Zoe going into veterinary science and various other bits and pieces, we probably need to, in our 2021 London location reports, encompass the joys of Kew Gardens.
Oh gosh, well it's on my doorstep, and every day is different, and it's like going to a different museum every day. It really is spectacular and everything about it is wonderful. Just been to the light show that they have around Christmas time and it's magical, it really is. And I'm not in a cheesy Disneyfied way, but it just is
nothing
magical.
Wrong with cheesy Disneyfication.
Well, I don't know, I'm beginning to wonder about Disney myself. Apparently they're going to open one near London. Another Disneyland.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, you know, Trump takes over the health service, you know, elections switch, we lose Scotland, we lose possibly Northern Ireland and Wales, we need a Disney.
Well, yeah, I'll reserve judgment on that.
Political point obviously taken out of the context of all sorts of things. Have you been to Kew Gardens, Zoe?
I have been to Kew Gardens. You're very lucky to have that on your doorstep, aren't you? I haven't been to their Christmas lights, but it looks amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, that you have a time ticket, so you've really got to stick to it. But the time I went last year was the coldest day of the year.
Oh my word.
But I had to invest in some gloves when I was in the shop because my fingers were dropping off. But it's worth it. It's definitely worth it.
And here was I, Anna, thinking that the weather here was just like Jersey.
Oh my goodness, no. No, Jersey has a microclimate and it's a strange old place, but I don't miss it one single bit.
So. All those years in Bergerac land and she comes back to London.
Never fall from the tree, right?
And your highlights today, Zoe Jameson. We'll hold fire on that while Zoe cogitates and ramifies on the whole sort of thing, etc. And it'd be a whole new world. Anna, we're going to get you some refreshments there. We're going to talk off-air about a whole variety of other bits and pieces. It's been a case of listening from the podcast listeners' point of view, and indeed our broadcaster too, Southside Broadcasting on location with Siren Radio, at the wonderful world of the Royal Academy and other bits of London in this fine December day. And that, what should we say, Zoe, to wrap up as a sort of like, any sort of catchphrase you'd actually say? Happy holidays?
No, that's very American. Merry Christmas.
Really? You're going Merry Christmas?
Yeah.
Okay. Anna, a 1, 2, 3.
Yes. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Everyone.